From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today on Capitol Hill, lawmakers are assessing worldwide threats to the country's security. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats walked the Senate Intelligence Committee through a litany of global crises.
You know, if you went out and hired a private plane and launched from Los Angeles and went around the world and stopped at every hot spot in this world, you would make multiple dozens of stops. That's the kind of threat that we face.
Coats was one of six major intelligence chiefs who testified, including FBI Chief Christopher Wray, whose agency is at odds with the Trump administration over White House staff security clearances and its ongoing Russia investigation. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been watching the hearing and joins us now. Hi, Greg.
Yeah. Hi, Jeremy. It's a scary world out there.
It is, I guess. So the Senate holds the worldwide threat assessment with intelligence chiefs every year. Between election meddling in North Korea and terrorism, was there a consensus about the biggest threat in 2018?
Well, we certainly got the world tour. If I had to pick out one spot, I think it would be North Korea. And the intelligence chiefs brought us right up to date. They said, for example, at the Olympics, where Kim Jong-un's sister has been present, and there's been sort of conciliatory talk and possible meetings between North and South Korea. Mike Pompeo, the CIA chief, was pretty dismissive, as were others, saying they don't see any strategic change. They still see this as a very, very serious threat. And above and beyond North Korea's nuclear program that we've heard so much about, even their conventional forces are quite large and present a potential threat. So this certainly got a lot of attention.
And what about a Russian election interference? Let's listen here once again to Dan Coats.
We expect Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, false flag personas, sympathetic spokesmen, and other means to influence to try to build on its wide range of operations and exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States.
We've been hearing from a lot of officials recently that Russia is already trying to meddle in the 2018 elections in this country.
That's right, and we did get an earful of that as well. In fact, Mark Warner, the senator from Virginia, asked all six of the intelligence chiefs if they agreed with Mike Pompeo that there's been no significant decrease in Russian activity, and they all did, including Pompeo himself, and they talked about the expectation that they're going to see more of it this year, and really it's quite striking to see these intelligence agencies talking about the need to work with private companies to prevent attacks, something a couple years ago you would see a pretty clear firewall between the government intelligence work and what private social media companies are doing.
Senator Marco Rubio said in this hearing that a threat even bigger than Russia is China. And there was a lot of talk about Chinese tech companies with ties to the Chinese government operating in the U.S. What did we learn about that?
Yeah, he tried to draw out this notion of China's long-term strategy, as he sees it, to replace the U.S. As the world's most powerful country. And he talked about what Chinese tech companies are trying to do to acquire technology. He also talked about a lot of what the Chinese are doing in academia, presenting something like the Confucius Institute as a joint project on U.S. university campuses, but really being a way to gather technology. Technology and cutting-edge information. And Dan Coats, the head of National Intelligence, and Chris Wray, the FBI head, did talk about this, as they called it, non-traditional collectors of intelligence. So this was a theme that did get a good deal of attention as well.
And Christopher Wray, the FBI director, also explained the timeline of former White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter's background check. Porter's accused of abusing his wives, and there were questions about what the White House knew and when. Did we get any clarity?
Yeah, we certainly did. Chris Wray was clearly prepared to answer this question. He said the FBI submitted a partial report last March and then a completed report in July. They got requests for follow-up, which they sent in November, and that they closed this file in January and then passed on a little more information this month. This is really at odds with the White House, which has said that it just got full information last week,
right,
and then Porter resigned.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie, keeping an eye on the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing today on Capitol Hill. Greg, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thousands of Puerto Rican families who fled Hurricane Maria are facing a deadline tomorrow. The families were evacuated to the mainland U.S., to Florida, New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. They've been housed in hotel rooms paid for by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Tomorrow, some of them may be told that they're losing their housing and have to go back to Puerto Rico. The FEMA has determined that their homes are now in livable condition. Paolo Serechia questions that finding, though. She's trying to help the families around New Haven, Connecticut, as part of the nonprofit group Junta for Progressive Action. Paolo, who are some of these people?
Well, right now, folks that are in the hotel are families and individuals. We receive the most vulnerable first. We have a gentleman that needs a kidney transplant, and he had to have an emergency parathyroid operation. And in the midst of all this, he was actually denied for an extension because his home was deemed habitable.
His home back in Puerto Rico.
And that's back in Puerto Rico.
And is his home habitable? I mean, FEMA deemed it so, sent people there to determine that. How do you know that's not true?
I would say it's habitable for the FEMA regulations. But when we really think about somebody that's doing dialysis three times a week, that needs more than just a generator for electricity and a blue tarp for a roof, that for us, seems like a place that they can't go back. So he is still here at the FEMA hotel. And just last night, a day before he's about to be discharged from FEMA, he called me to let me know that FEMA had actually extended.
How long is it extended for? I mean, what's his reprieve?
So his reprieve right now is till March 20th, I believe. And so hopefully that will give us enough time so that we can locate housing.
So are there other cases like this where technically a home is livable once again in Puerto Rico, but the reality is for these people who are living in the hotel in Connecticut, it would be impossible to go back home?
So, yes. So right now, we also have another family. They have a 2-year-old child with a neurological disorder. She is in an electric wheelchair, and they live up in the mountain part of Puerto Rico. And so in the mountain part, they have yet to receive sustainable electricity. They do have generators, and the power actually just went off yesterday due to an explosion. So somebody like that family would be very difficult for them to go back to their homeland.
From FEMA's point of view, they should go home. Do these families have an intention of going home eventually, or do they believe that the only services they could get, especially for those who have some kind of physical disability, that the only service that they can get would be here and they want to stay here permanently?
So it's a difficult question to answer because these are folks that did not want to leave Puerto Rico. An actual tragedy happened, a crisis in their island, and they had to leave. The piece of infrastructure and really rebuilding the hospitals is really where we're looking at with people with disability, that it would be very difficult for them to go back. And so they are looking to stay here in Connecticut. They are our new residents.
And how are they being helped in terms of settling eventually? It's costly for Connecticut. It's been costly for FEMA to have people stay in hotels. What is the way forward?
If we were really going to think about sustainable long-term success for self-sufficiency, having the ability to have some sort of affordable housing and also avenues for employment. Most people that I spoke with and we've seen over 850 individuals in the last 10 weeks have, most of them have worked. Most of them in Puerto Rico had a life, had a home, had businesses, and if there would be a way to create that avenue here in Connecticut.
Have any of them gotten jobs here?
Yes, actually. We have families that have contacted us that got employment, and then, of course, they need the next step, like getting their birth certificate from Puerto Rico, and so they could do taxes, and so we're providing that here at Junta for free of charge. But, yeah, people have gotten jobs, and people have been able to locate housing after they've been able to receive employment. It's just not enough time in a couple of months to redo your whole life, find employment, find housing, and even know what that one-way street in New Haven means.
Yes, a lot to get used to, including one-way streets.
Yes, a lot to get used to, yes.
Paula Sarechia of the nonprofit Junta, working to help Puerto Rican evacuees in the New Haven, Connecticut area. Thank you very much, Paula.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
All this week, we're taking a look at China's Belt and Road Initiative, a trillion-dollar global infrastructure investment that is taking place all over the world to reshape global trade. We'll hear in a moment from Kazakhstan. But first, Pakistan. Let's bring in the BBC's Harun Rashid in Islamabad. Harun, give us an idea of what Belt and Road looks like in Pakistan. What kind of projects is China working on?
Well, most of it is on papers as yet, and work on some of the projects has already begun. We are seeing a number of road projects being carried out at the moment. Some highways are being built and some motorways are being built and some new railway lines are commissioned. So work is going on them. There are around 20 power projects that Chinese are actively involved across the country. It includes coal plants, hydro projects and some other means of generating more electricity, because Pakistan has been deficient in power sector for a long time. So I think once these projects come into action, that we will be able to see the change and see some visible activity taking place across the country.
And China's cooperation with Pakistan goes beyond infrastructure. There are some who suspect Pakistan could soon be home to China's second foreign military base. Is military cooperation part of Belt and Road in Pakistan?
Well, this issue does come up from time to time, and both the Pakistani and the Chinese officials have denied that this corridor project involves any military from the Chinese side, and they are not planning any setting up any military base in Pakistan. But if the Pakistani authorities are not able to curb violence against Chinese across the country, then we might see the possibility of Chinese military stepping in. But at the moment, there is no talk of Chinese military getting involved.
What about the issue of India? China is building in the disputed region of Kashmir over the objections of India. How is that playing out, and how does China's construction there change the dynamics of the relationship between Pakistan and India?
Well, I mean, whenever there is tension between India and China on their joint border, it is widely reported in the local media here. And I think, I mean, there is a reason for that. I think Pakistan always has projected China as a superpower that can counter or control India's influence in this region.
And how do ordinary Pakistanis feel about this Chinese investment? Are they happy about it? Is there suspicion about it?
Well, I mean, Pakistan over the last 15 or 16 years has seen consistent violence. The problem of militancy was one big problem that Pakistan was not being able to control. But over the last couple of years, the Pakistani military has carried out a successful military operation against the militants, and things have calmed down relatively well. So now, I mean, the focus both of the government, it seems, and the ordinary citizens is on economic well-being. Pakistan has a huge 200 million population. Of this, some say around 60% is youth between the age of 18 to 24. So, I mean, all this huge bulge of youth would want jobs, would want better infrastructure. So everyone is looking forward to this investment, and they hope that the Pakistanis benefit from it. But there are already some fears being expressed in some sections of the Pakistani society that only China will benefit from this huge project, and Chinese presence will increase in this region, that could destabilize this region. But I mean, the dominant thing is that people are quite looking forward to the economic boom that it might cause.
They think that Pakistanis will be given the jobs to build these things.
Yes, they hope so. But we spoke to the Chinese ambassador in Pakistan last week, and he gave us this figure that there are already 10,000 Chinese working on different projects in the country around China-Pakistan corridor project. There are several industrial zones that are to be set up around these routes. And for that, China would be bringing in their own manpower. So there is this fear that, yes, Chinese might benefit more than the Pakistanis from these projects.
Does China's involvement in Pakistan affect how Pakistan views other powers in the world like the United States?
Yes, it does. I think Pakistan, it seems, with its actions and with its statements, is trying to tell the U.S. that it's no more dependent on them economically and that they are more keen on getting along with the Chinese than anyone else. And once these projects do start bearing fruit, that their reliance on other countries would come down considerably.
That's the BBC's Haroon Rashid joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Haroon, thank you.
Welcome, Shami.
And China's Belt and Road Initiative is also remaking parts of Central Asia. Let's go now to the border between China and Kazakhstan, which is home to a massive new dry port, a key hub for China's new Silk Road across Asia. Hisham Belmashi is CEO of the Khorgos Eastern Gate Special Economic Zone. He joins us now from Khorgos, Kazakhstan via Skype. Hisham, describe where you are right now and what was it like before China's Belt and Road Initiative and what does it look like now?
So I arrived in 2015. When I landed, basically, it was only desert. It was what we called at that time the middle of nowhere.
Hmm.
3 years later, we can see and we can witness a huge development of infrastructures, roads, ports, warehouses, and more to come, of course, in the coming years.
And why is this spot the spot, which, by the way, it's 90 miles from the Eurasian Pole of Inaccessibility, which is the point on Earth furthest away from any ocean? Why is this the place that China was so interested in?
Yes, indeed, we are very far, but we should not forget that we are at the border of the biggest probably country in the world in terms of population. It's also one of the biggest producer in the world, exporter in the world. So it makes total sense that tomorrow this gate that we call the Eastern Gate of Kazakhstan will be very important for the transit of cargo between China, Central Asia, and Europe. So there is the special economic zone of Khorgos East Gate. And this is where all the goods that are coming by train from China and crossing Kazakhstan on the way to Central Asia or to Europe has to stop, because the rail between China and Kazakhstan are different in size, and the train has to make the stop at this border to do what we call a transshipment, a movement of cargo from Chinese train to the Kazakh train, and then will be distributed in the Eurasian Custom Union, that's including, for example, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, Belarus, and why not up to Europe? Because again, we are only 10 days from Europe.
And what kind of goods are moving through the dry port?
Today, the operation of movement of goods by train is not something new to this region. It has been done for years. And of course, it's all type of goods that you can imagine, that you can see in the stores. It can be the same goods that you have in the US or in Europe. It can be fridges. It can be garments, it can be textile, and shoes. So every type of goods that today are produced in China and that are, of course, sold to this region.
And is the flow of goods moving in both directions, or is it mostly coming from China to the West?
Of course, majority of the goods, I would say more than 80%, it's moving from China up to Central Asia and Europe. And this imbalance is observed everywhere in Europe, but also in the US, of course, because China is the factory of the world and it's difficult to compete with it. However, by creating a hub at this perfect location, which is Korgos, you will be able to basically bring flows from different areas, from Europe, for example, that will come to connect in Korgos to come back with those empty trains that are coming back to China. In the past, we didn't have such facilities that can, let's say, consolidate flows from different regions. And this is where Korgos will play a major role into channeling all those goods in one single point to reduce the cost of transportation, which will create a snowball effect, of course, more and more goods transiting through this region.
And are the jobs going to people from Kazakhstan, or are they mostly Chinese workers?
No, we are talking only about majority of the jobs are for Kazakh people. So the idea is, of course, to start by training the local population and bring a new know-how in the region.
So what's next for Belt and Road in Kazakhstan?
So for me, I see this is just the beginning. We are still very far. There is a highway that will be fully operational by the end of this year, which we call the Western China, Western Europe Highway, stretching from China up to St. Petersburg and crossing Korgos. So we are at the beginning of something, let's say, an ongoing process. And the idea is to see maybe in 5 or 10 years in this border, maybe 5 to 10 million people probably living there and benefiting from these synergies that all those infrastructures has created. And of course, bring new type of businesses for Kazakhstan and trade between, let's say, Kazakhstan and China.
That's Hisham Belmashi, who's CEO of the Korgos Eastern Gate Special Economic Zone. That's part of China's Belt and Road Initiative in Kazakhstan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the most iconic skyscrapers in Chicago's skyline has lost its name. The John Hancock Center was completed in 1970. It's 100 stories tall, and the Hancock Center is now being called just by its address, 875 North Michigan Avenue. That's the case at least until the building's owners sell new naming rights. Joining us now is Ryan Ory, commercial real estate columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
And this has been a rumor for many months. Why is it happening now?
Well, the owners of the John Hancock Center have been talking about doing a naming rights deal with a new company for some time. The naming rights deal with John Hancock expired a few years ago, and now the parent company of John Hancock, which is Manulife Financial, has told the owners to essentially cease using the name. And so for right now, the building's just going to go by its address, 875 North Michigan Avenue.
Just going to go by officially. But if everybody's been calling it the Hancock Building for so long, how do you stop people from doing that?
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially the owners being told, you know, this is what you need to call it, you know, in your official capacity as owners. That's certainly not going to stop Chicagoans from calling it the John Hancock. It's been almost a full decade now since Sears Tower changed names in a naming rights deal. It's now Willis Tower. There are many, many Chicagoans who, you know, will
still call it Sears Tower.
Just refuse to utter the words Willis Tower. You know, there was also when Marshall Fields became Macy's, you know, a not Chicago brand. There's a huge flagship on State Street, and, you know, many people still, you know, refuse to call that building anything other than Marshall Fields Building.
Well, and you point out in your article, by the way, that there's a Hancock Tower in Boston that's not the Hancock Tower anymore. I didn't even realize that, but they call it also
right
by its address at this point.
Right. You know, in an official capacity, you know, hey, building owner, stop using the name. And that doesn't mean people will just instantaneously stop thinking of it as that, you know.
So will there be a new name at some point? Is there a market for naming a big skyscraper like that building?
Yeah, so Well, first of all, it's an unusual building because there are several portions of the building owned by different owners. But the owner of the office and parking spaces in the tower own the naming rights. And so they were looking to sell the building. They were marketing it as an opportunity for the buyer to sign a new naming rights deal. They think it could be worth $1.5 million or more annually. They have turned down some offers that they said were not, I don't know, iconic enough names. I think at one point the owner said, you know, we're not going to have it be Jiffy Lube Tower or something like that, you know. So
oh.
They want it to be a big kind of iconic brand that maybe would resonate in Chicago.
So maybe Lou Malnati's Pizza Tower.
I think there would be some support for that.
So you're the commercial real estate columnist there at the Chicago Tribune. There are new skyscrapers going up. As we said, this one was completed in 1970. Do they all get names, or is it usually just the address?
You know, a lot of buildings just end up being known by their address. There are some instances where a naming rights deal is often connected to a large lease. So you sign an anchor tenant to a new building, and you throw in the naming rights, or you sell it to them as a separate aspect of the deal. But there are many buildings that don't have a name. And so right now, this is officially, anyway, one of them.
That's Ryan Ori, who's a commercial real estate columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll still call it the Hancock, and I'll still call it the Sears Tower.
One of the most anticipated films of the year opens this Friday, The Black Panther.
My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
35 million people have watched the Black Panther trailer online. The movie has shattered ticket presale records, so much so that even one of its stars, Lupita Nyong'o, tweeted she couldn't get a ticket online. And Chadwick Boseman, the American actor who plays the superhero king of a fictional and technologically advanced African nation, graces the cover of this week's Time magazine. Let's bring in journalist Jesse Holland, who covers race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. He wrote the Marvel novel, Who is the Black Panther? Jesse, let's start there. Who is the Black Panther?
Well, the Black Panther was actually the first black mainstream superhero. So the character itself has a long history in comic books going all the way back to 1966. Now, the excitement about the movie is about the fact that there's never been a mainstream superhero movie with a cast like this.
Cast, I mean, because there are people like who?
Like Chadwick Boseman. You have Forrest Whitaker. You have Angela Bassett. You have a majority black cast.
Lupita Nyong'o.
Yeah, exactly. In a major Marvel movie. Now, Marvel has been ruling the Hollywood movie world for the last few years. But they've never put money into a major movie like this, a movie where young black kids can go see superheroes who look just like them. The entire cast looks just like them. So just as we saw a huge movement behind Wonder Woman, which was the first female-led superhero movie, we're seeing the same thing behind Black Panther.
So if Black Panther has been around since the mid-60s, why is this happening right now?
As we're seeing in a lot of entertainment, Hollywood is trying to diversify. Hollywood is moving out of the same old stories that they've been using for years and years and years. And in fact, we're seeing a renaissance, especially for black superheroes. You have the CW with its series Black Lightning. You have Luke Cage on Netflix. So we're seeing Hollywood realizing that you can tell these type of stories with characters of different colors and gender, and everyone will want to see them.
So for people who grew up with the Black Panther, they're like over the moon about the movie and about your book as well. For those who didn't, the character is really interesting, the character T'Challa. Maybe you can tell us about him. And also the story itself, it happens in a make-believe African nation of Wakanda. This is a place that has hidden itself from the rest of the world for a reason.
Right. It's vibranium. Wakanda is the only country on the planet that has a rich deposit of this metal called vibranium. And vibranium sort of does exactly what the name implies. It absorbs vibrations. So that is one of the materials that Captain America's shield is made from. And the only place you can get it is from this African country that is very isolationist. They don't want anybody coming in that country.
So it makes a superhero indestructible.
Pretty much. The Black Panther's costume has veins of vibranium running through it. So when you shoot at him, the bullets just hit the suit and stop. And his whole family, their entire existence has been about protecting that mound of vibranium in Wakanda from the rest of the world.
And is that the only reason the country wants to be kind of underground?
Well, one of the great stories about Wakanda is that what we see and envision Wakanda to be is an African country that was never colonized, that never had any of the influences of the invading Europeans. So in this world, in the Marvel world, Wakanda has become the most technologically advanced country on the planet because they have never been touched by the outside world. But as the story of the Black Panther goes, they're beginning to open up their shores to outside influences, and that's where the story takes off.
So how did you take off from that with the book? Where did you go with it?
Well, the original origin of the Black Panther comes from 1966 from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Marvel then hired Reginald Hudlin to rewrite that origin in the 2000s. Well, when the movie, they got ready to start filming the movie, Marvel came to me and said, we want you to update that origin to 2017, 2018, and it will fit the world of today. In fact, I start part of the book right here in Washington, D.C., at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, which, of course, didn't exist before the last couple of years. So I get to play with things I get to see every day.
This is really funny because you're a politics and culture reporter, and politics and culture wars very much seep into the novel and into the movie as well. So what do you see every day in your reporting for AP that you decided you wanted to weave into the story?
Part of what I used to base the book on were things I see every day here in Washington. How a country in Africa who is technologically advanced would relate to the United States. What people in Africa would think about race relations here in the United States. Exactly how the Pentagon would deal with a country that is just as technologically advanced as America, a country that could actually defend itself from the United States. What would that relationship be like? And that was one of the questions I thought about and wanted to make sure I included in the book.
Let me ask you, though, about what young women and girls might take away from this tale. Because the king, King T'Challa, has an all-female sisterhood of security guards. This is where Lupita Nyong'o, the actress, comes into the film. The security guards, quote, serve his every need and call him beloved. Sounds a little untimely. What do you do with things like that?
Well, that's one of the things that we had to do when we were updating the origins of the Black Panther. So we had to take into account that some things that happened in the 1960s weren't really appropriate for the world of today. For example, the Black Panther's comic book used to be called Jungle Action. So that would never work for today. But what we tried to do is we tried to take these themes, especially the themes of the Adora Mahali, who is the all-female bodyguard unit of the Black Panther, and explain why something like that might exist. In fact, the Adora Mahali exists only because way back in the past, they were considered to be trainees, wives in training for the Black Panther. But over the years, instead of becoming wives in training, what they became is an elite unit of warriors. And they were, I have to say, they were some of the best parts of writing this book, to be able to write this strong sisterhood of women for whom the Black Panther depends on. And the country, his country, wouldn't work without them. So you take those old themes that the comic book writers used in the past, and you try to make them make sense in a world of today. And I think, once again, the Adora Mahali are going to be the best parts of the movie, and they definitely were some of my favorite parts of writing in the book.
I know you see this as part of a resurgence of Black superheroes and characters in popular culture. Where else are you seeing them in particular?
Well, one of the places that I'm seeing them more and more is not just on the screen, but being used as symbols in American culture. Back when I was reporting in Ferguson after the Michael Brown death, I started seeing images of the Black Captain America that's being used by Marvel being used in protests. And I think we'll see a lot of the images of the Black Panther around the country now that the movie is about to hit and then the book is out. So I think not only are they going to be entertainment on the screens, but they'll also be used as icons, as symbols of the way this country is diversifying and about how we see ourselves as a country. We don't see ourselves in just one color or two color anymore. We see ourselves as a huge diversified country whose heroes can be of any race. It's not just a story of a man running a country. It's of man and his family and the women around him. And I'm hoping that's the next thing that Marvel does, find a strong Black female superhero and put her on screen.
Jesse, do you have any children?
I have an 11-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son.
That's like a perfect demographic for this.
Exactly. One of the things that I did while I was writing the book, The Black Panther, I read it to them. Because that's the audience that will tell you straight out, hey, Daddy, we love all of the great themes you're doing, but when are you going to get around to the fight scene?
And yeah, so, exactly. That's right.
In the end, you've got to have the excitement to draw people to the themes that you want to write about. Honor, power, and family. Those were the themes that I love exploring the most.
Even if you have to get there after a few good kicks and punches.
Exactly. And a backflip or two.
Associated Press reporter, comics fan, and author of Marvel's Who is the Black Panther novel. Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
Amazon is planning to cut hundreds of jobs at its Seattle headquarters and elsewhere in a surprising move from a company that has been rapidly expanding for years. The news was first reported by the Seattle Times, which said Amazon is aiming to streamline its consumer retail business. For a look at this and other tech news, we're joined now by Ina Fried. She's chief technology correspondent for Axios. Ina, welcome back.
Good to be here, Jeremy.
And these hundreds of jobs make up just a fraction of Amazon's workforce of more than 500,000. But this is a company that's been growing for years and they want to open a second headquarters. What's going on?
Yeah, and they still are growing. I mean, they have thousands of open jobs. I mean, this is a company that's still swallowing whole industries. But, you know, it's a sign any company that grows fast, you know, I think it's prudent to purely kind of look at, you know, what is everyone doing? And there probably are people whose jobs aren't as relevant as they once were. So, you know, you see this at Microsoft and Facebook and other companies that are still growing fast, but also kind of rethinking some of what they do. So I think it's a sign of maturity, not of a slowdown.
But overall, Amazon is doing still very well right now.
Yeah, I mean, their growth in their core businesses has been very strong, and they've been, as I mentioned, swallowing whole industries. So not only did they buy Whole Foods, which kind of everyone noticed, but they're moving into other areas, healthcare. There's a report from the Wall Street Journal today that they're looking at how can they supply more goods to hospitals. This is a company that is always looking at what are the next really big opportunities and has been executing extremely well on that.
And one of them is that Amazon wants to get into package delivery for businesses competing with companies like UPS and FedEx. Tell us what they're looking at there.
Sure. So Amazon has already been one of the biggest customers for the Postal Service as well as express delivery companies. And they've struggled with, you know, do they just rely on those companies? Do they do delivery on their own? And so increasingly, just to meet their own business needs, they've been delivering packages on their own. And so I think it's a logical next step that once you're delivering a ton of your own packages, why not deliver packages for others? And we've seen Amazon do this before. If you look at their web services business, that's a huge billion-dollar business that grew out of Amazon had its own web services to power its site, and why not offer those to others? So we've seen Amazon build first for itself, but then look if there's other markets to buy the services it needs already for itself.
Some other tech stories I want to get your thoughts on, starting with Facebook, which says it lost about 2.8 million users in the U.S. last year. What's going on there?
So there's a couple things going on, and this is obviously a big deal for Facebook. They're in the crosshairs of a lot of things right now, certainly under fire for fake news and for, you know, exacerbating the filter bubble and all these complaints. I think there's two things going on. I think core Facebook has an issue that they are well aware of and deal with pretty well, which is their user base gets older. Social networks are always kind of tied to a generational thing. And Facebook has done a really good job. It's why they bought WhatsApp. It's why they bought Instagram, of recognizing that, you know, my kids aren't going to use the same social network I do, at least not when they're teenagers. So that's the sort of known problem. I think the problem that's new for them is this issue of, it's just not as fun as it was when we were looking at our friends' baby pictures, like hearing people's political rant. You know, it's exhausting, and I want to break from it. Facebook used to be that break, and now they're just another place where I am inundated with the divisive social issues of the time. And that's a challenge for Facebook.
But probably still the social media network with the best financial situation, would you say, or is that not right?
For sure. I mean, Facebook, you know, unless you're going to count Google in that category, right. I mean, Facebook and Google get the lion's share of all the advertising dollars. It's where people spend a ton of time. So it's very concerning, obviously, if people are spending less time or fewer people are going to the site, because that's less advertising inventory to sell. But Facebook has done extremely well at both monetizing its site and, you know, really capturing the lion's share of the dollars in social networking.
Meanwhile, Apple got some good news. Estimates say it shipped about 8 million smartwatches last quarter. That makes it one of the largest of any watchmakers in the world.
It does, although I still put this in the niche category. I mean, they sell more than the Swiss watchmakers, but the Swiss watches sell for a whole lot more, at least the high-end ones. You know, nothing to sneeze at. They've grown this business steadily. It's growing faster. I think more people are picking these up. I do think there's still a challenge for Apple and Fitbit and others of taking these from nice-to-haves to truly compelling devices. And I think you're seeing Apple and Fitbit both push harder into the healthcare arena, really seeing that as the way that these things become a must-wear accessory.
But you're saying they're not there yet. They're still a niche category.
I think so. I think most of the uses, you know, counting steps, tracking sleep, running some apps, getting some notifications, these are nice things. But I think when they can help people manage chronic health conditions, that's when things really shift. Fitbit today announced it's buying a Boston-based health startup, in part because of this. And both Apple and Fitbit have been working hard to find true medical uses for these devices.
That's Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios, joining us from San Francisco. Ina, thank you.
Thanks.
Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.